Another episode of Hobbit in Canada. I'm your host, Tom, and with me this week are...
Dan.
Mike.
Steve.
And fuck you, Ward.
Yeah,
so, okay. I have to ask, because it hasn't gone up yet, but did you guys say fuck you to me when I was not here?
What? No, maybe.
No.
I don't know. Did not.
No.
What?
We may not have. We're a lot nicer than you, man.
Yeah. Oh, man. Jesus.
Way fucking nicer.
I'd feel bad if I had a soul. Okay, so let's jump right into what we've done in the hobby. Steve?
Hobby's been a little light this week. Started putting together a Talos for my sixth Talos. I think I am now get one free on the punch card. I'm pretty sure how this works.
What's the max unit for Talos?
You get a free small-sized non-deluxe Talos.
Exactly. I get a base model Talos. No,
you can get extra pickles for free.
Correct. On my Talos. I don't know.
I thought we were going with the, like, get your seventh coffee free metaphor.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Pickle coffee would be weird. But I was thinking, like, no lattes.
I was going for cheeseburger. But okay.
You can't get a Haywire Blaster on your free Talos. You got to go Stinger Pod. We'll go with that.
Okay.
So I did that. Did a little bit more work on my knights. Got, actually, this isn't really related to the hobby, but I got the banners from Shapeways Inn that I'm really quite impressed with. So that's going to be next on the hobby docket, is doing some freehand on some really cool banners to stick out of the top of the night.
That's
cool.
Yeah.
Mikey, what have you built this week?
I put together three get starting boxes, the Orlok box, the Goliath, the Van Sar, the noodle thing from Arsenal.
Oh yeah, the noodle stand.
Noodle stand. And
which sounds weird if you don't know, if you haven't Googled it, Google it. It's awesome.
Yeah. Pan Chan Lo or something's noodle. So, but anyways, that and the new spells for the Bloodbound. Nice. For AOS and
the prayers, not
the
prayers. Spells.
Okay, the prayers. I'm sorry, you caught me there. I have no excuse.
Corn doesn't have spells.
And the new scenery for the Bloodbound.
Nice. How big are the Bloodbound prayers? I'm interested.
What do you ask? Be a little more specific.
Like the skulls with the blood coming out of their eyes. The
skulls
only one that I want. What's the size?
Just a little bit bigger, in between what a quarter and a loony in diameter.
Oh, okay, a little smaller than I thought.
Yeah,
like this size.
No. That's closer to a nickel. There.
This size,
like a bottle cap kind of.
Bottle cap. Yes.
Okay. I realize I'm holding up things saying this size. Terrible radio.
Yeah.
But hey, whatever. We're not professionals. Never claimed to be.
If you expect more from us at this point, that's on you.
Totally.
Yeah.
It's quite a bit. It's quite a bit of stuff.
Which three get started boxes?
Two Bloodbound, one Vanguard. Yeah, there you go, three.
Goddamn.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff.
So, maybe 150 things put together?
That's upsetting. Daniel, how about you?
I built and primed another Space Marine Captain. Woo!
Nice.
Another Smash Captain?
Yeah, this guy's got another like hybrid heresy armor type thing. He actually has a storm shield.
Ooh.
And the hammer is like the one from the Mark III kit. And it's actually kind of neat where I put some of the little etched brass icons on the side of the hammer and stuff, like the little tiny ones. Stuff like that. So
that'll be cool.
He's looking pretty cool. Yeah, he'll get done at some point in the future, probably. He didn't get done in the past.
It would make sense.
But, in other words, I'm stalling for Tom because I didn't paint shit.
Tom?
I painted a Nurgle Blood Bowl team. And then, that was fun. and then I also, and I converted up a couple stars for that. I'll talk a little bit more about that team in a few minutes. I also started putting together an old Third Ed Blood Bowl Goblin team. And I got all the models together, got the airbrushing done for the skin, and got six models up to fully base coating everything and washing it down to just get some highlights thrown on. So
nice. It's awesome.
Yeah, that was today.
That's pretty solid.
So, yeah.
Did you do anything other than just today?
For the goblins?
Yeah.
No.
Okay, gotcha. Anything else hobby-wise other than today? Well, you said that. It sounded like you did.
Yeah, no, the Blood Bowl team
the
was...
The Nurgle team.
The Nurgle Blood Bowl team was... I started them a couple weeks ago.
Tournament was just this last weekend.
Yeah, so it was Saturday, Sunday. I started them a few weeks back, and then due to, like, starting new meds that, like, kicked the crap out of me, I didn't do anything hobby for about 2 weeks.
Gotcha.
And then last week I got the team finished up, so.
Solid.
Yeah.
We got to do Shut Up and Take My Money.
We do.
Because your hobby was attempting to put a valve cover on a car and other car-related things?
Pretty much. 100% it was. That's not entirely true. I did do a little bit of work on the knights. I got the fist built and that kind of stuff. So there was a little bit of paint work done, but you're mostly right. Very, very car-related, not a lot of actual hobby-related stuff.
That's fair.
But my Shut Up and Take My Money is a few weeks out, but another White Dwarf, because the Inari Codex is coming out in May. And
in White Dwarf form?
In White Dwarf form. I'm very excited for this. Because I really hope it's just Codex Yunkarn. And it's just stratagems for the Yunkarn and rules for the Yunkarn. That's all I care about. I love that model. It's my favorite thing to play. I really hope they don't fuck it up. Very excited for that.
Well, that's an interesting one. I didn't even hear about that one coming out. So
yeah, the back cover got leaked for April's White Dwarf. And it's on the back cover next month, Yunari. So I'm assuming it's a Yunari Codex. It's really the last one to do. I don't think it warrants its own book anyways, so it would make sense to be in.
It would be really great if it was like a little supplement, kind of like they did with the Orlok. Not Orlok. Was it?
The Assassins.
No, the...
The Vansars had one for... Or sorry, no, it was Dalok.
Dalok.
Yeah. Dalok.
That's the one, yeah.
That's the one.
Oh, they had their own book?
Yeah, it was a separate little book.
They did a tiny little, like, couple of page booklet in White Dwarf. For the people that had been buying all the Gang War books and felt like they'd been ripped off because they were being accumulated into one book, they were like, well, if you just have all the other stuff and you just want the Deluxe, we're going to put this little mini thing in the White Dwarf.
That's actually really cool. I do hope they do that. But I wouldn't be surprised if it was just like what they did with the Officio Assassinorum stuff. Because really, they have three data sheets that they need to go through. They have the three characters. It's less than the Assassins. Give them some stratagems and rework Soul Burst, and boom, you're good to go.
Yeah, fixing Soul Burst is obviously kind of the big issue. Yeah. Because
well,
that's a tricky one to balance.
They nerfed it into Oblivion, so now it's actually like only good on a couple of units.
Yeah.
And it's hard to pull off. Like, and it's one of those feel-bad mechanics. Like, if you can pull it off consistently in a game, like I did to Matt Posey with my Dark Reapers, where I couldn't fail casting Soul Burst and everything just worked... It's one of the most devastating things to play against in the entire game. But those other games where you just fail a couple psychic tests and your army just sucks, it's just a bad mechanic. So I'm really looking forward to that. Mike?
Actually, nothing new. It's pretty much catch up on stuff that's already been released, but I couldn't afford to buy because there's too much at once.
I know that feel.
I'm going to try and clean up so I have the last two Necromunda gangs. Then I'll have them all. And then maybe Shadow Spear.
I think I'm going to start calling you Ash.
Why?
You got to catch them all.
Yeah. I can't help it.
Okay.
Would you like to be his Pikachu?
Sometimes. Dan.
I wish I knew the lyrics to the Pokemon theme song. Oh, God, I started singing it.
I want to be the very best.
Don't.
Like,
no.
No one don't. Ever was.
Oh, okay, let's not.
I'm impressed. I'm impressed, man. I know none of those words, but well, I know the words, just not in the order that I mix them into a song, preferably with a melody.
Yeah, well, the melody was a little
questionable,
dodgy.
A little,
yeah, correct.
Hey.
Oh, that's fantastic. For me, I'm having a hard time thinking of anything else either. The Shadow Spear has definitely got to be a thing still at some point.
Yep.
There's a couple of Forge World little packs and upgrades and shit that are slowly working their way into my awareness of things that I need for a Raven Guard. Because, like, I just don't have enough chapter shoulder pads or anything to finish building some of the things that I want to start building.
Yeah.
So, a few little things like that I need to pick up that are rapidly snowballing. But yeah, nothing too crazy just yet. Most of the new releases that are getting teased or announced haven't really, caught my eye just yet, so...
Nice.
I mean, the Slaanesh stuff is awesome, but I don't need it. So.
Oh,
yeah.
My God, I actually really want that Keeper.
Those models are hot.
Yeah, they're really nice.
Upsetting, androgynous, terrible, not really sure what's happening way.
Perfect.
Exactly. Whereas that aesthetic is actually bang on, like nailed with the keeper.
Yeah, it's perfect.
It started with the guy with like the harp growing out of his back or whatever from the Wrath and Rapture.
Yeah,
like,
I forgot about that.
That is a really solid aesthetic that is super Slaanesh-y. Like, they haven't done Slaanesh stuff in a very long time that looked at like any kind of appealing to me. Like, not like in a weird, creepy way, but like it just it's not a look that I want those miniatures in my collection.
Okay, hand checked in.
No, but that keeper is fucking cool.
Yeah.
Just so goddamn cool.
They're doing really cool things. It's looking like the good Chaos Demon art rather than like the bad Chaos Demon art.
And you know what? They actually,
you know what I mean?
The one thing that I find interesting is with that particular line, like they had a very fine line to walk in that aesthetic because they obviously wanted to make the models a lot more PG than they have been in the past, which is a fair point because they're models that kids play this game. Like there actually does make some sense to me to have them be a little bit more modest, but at the same time, like not completely change the aesthetic because there is that background behind it and the line that they managed to walk to keep it creepy and a little bit weird and off-putting, but not just be overly sexualized like a lot of them in the past have been.
Well, and not just to be PG, but also to be, you know, not just a bunch of tits and ass.
Yep, totally.
Yeah, like the actual androgynous aesthetic is normally a very hard thing to capture, I think, but they're actually doing it now. It's not just a bunch of, like six-boobed women with claw hands.
Yeah.
And that's really their entire aesthetic. Yeah.
Totally.
It was for a good 5 or 6 years.
Well, no, I mean, it was a shock factor. Like, when a Slaanesh army, the as we affectionately called it, the booby worm, was put on the table, it was a weird and upsetting model, but it wasn't necessarily because it was a nice sculpt. Do you know what I mean?
No.
No. It actually was in a lot of ways.
The rider, well done. The rider was a beautiful sculpt. The worm itself was meh. I think, because, that had the Slaanesh prince, right, with the spear on the top and the banner.
Yeah, the big mohawk thing.
He was cool.
Yeah.
Anyways, I totally cut you off because I forgot about Slaanesh entirely. No, that's okay. I won't be buying any, but I kind of want one.
No, it's okay. I'm just fucked anyways because, so they decided to take a look at the Chaos Space Marine book, and I wasn't really here last week to talk about any of this. And it seems like everything they're doing aggressively right now for, like, revamping Chaos Marines is basically Demon Engines.
Yep.
And Warp Smiths. And how they can all synergize and be mutated and super cool.
Yep.
And I have to buy them all.
Yep. The Lord Discordant is fucking cool.
I'm actually really happy that I haven't bought the Chaos Marine book yet, so when I do pick it up, it'll be the new one.
Nice. Yeah.
So, and honestly, it's like, I'm probably just going to be doing an Iron Warrior army that's a whole bunch of the cool demon engines.
Yeah. And you can make it work.
Havocs with the miniguns?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, except those are one per kit. Every other heavy weapon is two per kit.
You put a multi-barreled cannon on a heavy bolter and it looks like exactly the same.
Yeah, you got assault cannons from your old Kalth stuff, I think, right? From the Assault Marines, or not the Assault Marines, the Terminators? Or
I don't think that they wouldn't have had assault cannons. Assault cannons were not around in the
Honestly, I have
assault. No, the Dreadnought. Mike's right. I'm thinking
I have assault cannons from all of the unopened boxes of Space Marine Terminators that I saw.
Oh, that's even better.
Yeah, multi-barreled shenanigans to put on the tip of a heavy bolter is not that difficult.
Also, I've played orcs for over a decade, so plastic card is also a thing.
Yeah, true. It's interesting. The new obliterators, there's clearly something going on with their points values in the Vigilist stuff because they're still listed as 65 points per model, which is absurd. And it, frankly, if they stay at 65 points per model or whatever it is, incredible. But their power level suggests they're probably going to be more like 120 a model, which is crazy.
Which is still worth it.
It's a little high. 65 is too low. 120 is too high. There's got to be a Goldilocks thing going on there somewhere.
Yeah, like 90 to 100.
Yeah. We'll see what happens when they actually...
But
65 is crazy.
Either way, the models are fucking cool. And like that Lord Discordant. Oh my God.
Yep, I agree.
Like, oh my God. It is so fucking cool. And fucking Abaddon. And the way it works now is I can easily just do a Black Legion... Supreme Command attachment, take Abaddon and a couple sorcerers or something.
Yep.
Fuck. Speaking of sorcerers, Jesus Christ, those models are great.
Which one?
Well, there's the like the sorcerer with the two acolytes.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot about them entirely.
Yeah.
Well, that's not a sorcerer. That's a apostle, dark apostle.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Well, again, he's like it's like the Khorne thing. He has prayers, not spells. They're different.
Whatever. They're cool.
I don't know anything about chaos. We should burn them all.
I like wood bearers. There's a difference.
No, there's not.
Trust me.
You're the worst. You're actually the worst.
Like, legit.
100% well, you're the worst.
No.
Erebus is. He's terrible.
He's absolutely terrible. Angron is tragic. Tragic and angry.
Do you mean Angron or Karn?
Angron, because you have the butcher's nails.
Yeah, but he was kind of always a dick, where Karn at least was cool.
Yeah, true. I'll give you that. But it is a little bit tragic. He was always a dick because of the butcher's nails.
I thought Magnus was the most tragic, to be honest.
Yes.
He did nothing wrong.
He did nothing wrong. Except for he ruined Terra almost.
Yeah.
The fucking Kool-Aid man through the seals in the Emperor's Palace.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And just wrecked the webway entirely. Yeah, that was a good time.
But no, it's going to be good. And frankly, that army's going to paint up really quick. Like really, really quick. So, fuck me.
Nice. So, speaking of stuff you painted, what'd you do this weekend?
So, I was at March Madness, which has a tagline now, Nurgling's Gone Wild.
Which is fantastic, and because they've really riffed on one very small detail on one model in the last 2 years.
And we're not just talking about basketball here, people.
Yeah, this is a Blood Bowl tournament that happens in Calgary every year, and Jack is he probably loves Nurgle more than I do. I think he's got 3 or 4 Nurgle teams for Blood Bowl, either actually being Nurgle or converted to be other things.
Cool.
And he fell in love with the sassy Nurgling.
As most of us have.
As everyone has, except unlike most of us, they're just like, oh, I love that model, and then, like, never even buy the kit it comes in or anything else.
Does he come in?
It is the Nurgle Chaos Lord, like one of the...
That does not narrow it down for the place.
No, it's one of the Death Guard ones.
It was the new Death Guard sculpt, but I don't think it's the Chaos Lord.
Well, it's
one of their characters. I will find
out. It's a Lord-like character. but anyway, so he decided to use this as the, like, the mascot for his event, and he named him Melvin.
Melvin sounds like a beauty.
Melvin is a beauty. So I brought this all here to show you guys, because I just wanted to talk about how much fucking swag there was. So just for showing up, and I think it was $35 to register for this event if you registered early, there's a coin with Melvin on it. The front side's Melvin, the back side is Melvin's backside. There's actually, like, a sculpt of Melvin, because he was used in games. And this sculpt is, like, close to the size of a Primaris Marine.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Yeah, he's a beefy little guy.
So he's huge. There was 2d6, two of which were from Maelstrom Gaming, which is Jack's company that makes all the pitches and everything. Mm-hmm. Two with Melvin on them. There was a Melvin patch. There was a handful of tokens that you can use. The tournament itself was fucking wild, because normally when you have Blood Bowl events, you have X number of gold that you can spend on your roster, and then they'll have some kind of small skill pack that you can take. In this one, there was no skill package. You were just able to take... You bought your skills as if they were something you paid for in league play, so like a regular skill's 20k, double skill's 30k, and then stat ups are either 30, 40, or 50, depending on what they are. And then you had 1.2 million to buy the whole roster. Now, they had the tier system set up so that the better teams could only put so many gold worth of upgrades on players. So, tier one... Oh, you got it?
Plague Marine Champion.
Yeah.
That was it. He's just a champion. He's got a warped face, and there's just the funny little Nurgling standing on his base. He comes up to his knee.
Very sassy.
Very sassy.
Yeah, so the tier 1 teams, like your elves and chaos dwarves and shit, could take up to 20k per player. Tier 2 could take up to 30k, which means you could take a regular skill or a double. Tier 3 could take up to 40k, which we'll talk about in a second, because the Nurgle team I painted up was tier 3.
Tier 3 can take up to 40k, like it.
Yeah, so that's two those regular
numbers,
skills.
Those numbers work for me.
Yeah. And then stunties could take up to 50k, so you could actually take, like, some of the more aggressive stat-ups on them if you wanted to.
Cool.
So I took a Nurgle team. I painted it up, actually. Jack approached me back at one of the tournaments earlier in the year, seeing if I was willing to paint up a team to be raffled off for this for the food bank.
Nice.
And he wanted it to be the Nurgle team, so I painted up a Nurgle team. I did it with all of the possible positionals and a couple star players. And it was just everyone that showed up got one raffle ticket. You'd buy more for $5 each. And it was just drawn at the end of the event. We ended up raising $500 on the nose for the food bank, which apparently the food bank down there gets a 5-to-1 ratio when it's cash. going towards the food, so it effectively ends up being $2,500 worth of food. Nice. And that was 28 awesome. Players that did that.
That's awesome.
Which was fantastic. Unfortunately, I did not win my own team back because I was really enjoyed playing with it. And was
did you enter for yourself? I guess you had a raffle ticket. You might
have. I just got the one from entering.
I was really hoping.
I really wanted to win, but I didn't want to be that guy that wins back his own team, so I didn't put any more money into it.
Yeah.
And so it ended up going to Oren, who is a guy that was super thrilled to get him, so I'm happy that he got him. And anyway, so my build was pretty absurd, because the Nurgle team has general access to mutations on all the models. And mutations, the one that I really hammered home was Claw. And Claw, what it does, if you don't play Blood Bowl, it counts any opponent's armor as 7.
Scary. Oh. I don't know what that does.
So, 7 is like elf armor.
Okay. Oh, really
humans
bad.
Are normally 8. Orcs and dwarves and chaos are normally 9.
You just roll 2d6 to be armor.
2d6 if you roll higher.
So basically, if you have a Claw, it's 50-50 every single time you hit
Yeah.
Not quite, because you have to roll over.
Well, it gets stuck.
Okay. So it's like 43%.
So that was a 20k upgrade for 6 of my models.
And Mighty Blow?
2 of them got Mighty Blow, which adds +1 to either your armor break or injury roll.
Yep.
2 of them got Pylon, where you can knock your model over to re-roll the injury or the armor roll.
Nice.
And Block, just to be blocking. And then I had 1 Rotter with a... sorry, those skills were all on the bloaters and the pestigores. I had 1 rotter with leader, which gets me a reroll if it's on the pitch. And then I had 4 rotters with block and dirty player. Dirty player is basically mighty blow when you're fouling.
Nice.
So I only had the 1 leader reroll because I decided in my head, I was like, I've never played this team before, so I'm just going to go for 1 thing and 1 thing only. And that was just fucking murdering everything in front of me.
That sounds like a good plan.
And
never played in the scenario. That's the way to win.
Yeah, never play the scenario. it was not the way to win. The only reason I did not get dead last is because of my casualties. But yeah, basically, my first game I caused 6 casualties. Second game I caused 6 casualties. Third game was 5. Fourth game was 5. And then of all teams that I play against, only get 2 was against fucking goblins.
They're squirmy.
I couldn't roll anything higher than a 3, or like a 4 or 5.
Nice.
Except for obviously the 2 times I caused casualties. But it was abysmal. I only scored 1 touchdown all events, which is a new low for me. And fortunately,
is it really a new low or is it a new high? Because you clearly weren't trying to score touchdowns. You were there to mess people up.
Yeah. Honestly, the few times I picked up the ball was typically when it was a high kick or something. You had to place your model under where the ball is being kicked, and then you catch it. So I was like, well, fuck it, why not? I only gave up 5 touchdowns, which was 1 fewer than the person that got best defense.
That's not bad.
So, well, when you're murdering people, like, I pitch cleared another chaos team.
You literally killed everybody on the field?
Either killed or KO'd every model on his team.
That's amazing.
And you didn't score?
I did score in that game. That was the game I scored in.
So the only way you scored is when the other team isn't there.
Yeah. Well, that one was funny, too. Because he had 1 model left on the pitch. It was just a little beastman. I had it completely surrounded by models.
Yep.
And I just kept kicking it with a foul. and I would stun it and not knock it out.
Because you can only foul once per turn.
Because you can only foul once per turn. If they're knocked down, you can't do anything else. Yep. So I did the 1 foul, stun it, and then my 1 little fucking rotter moves 5 spaces a turn. It's just like, well, I'm going to start on my half with the ball and just go for it, because I mean, it's fucking well.
Yep.
And then his turn would be, I flip my model over. My turn would be, roll for the foul, stun, move the bloater 5 more forward, and so on and so forth.
So extremely dynamic gameplay.
My games were fast, man.
I gotta tell you right now, as a spectator watching that game, like, in the universe, you just see some guy just getting kicked slowly in the center, and a dude shambling to the other end. It'd be a terrible game to watch.
Yeah.
It'd be horrible.
Or just funny.
Just sad.
Yeah, just really sad. Everyone else is either dead or just, like, beaten up in the KO bin.
I kind of want there to be, like, a web series now. That is just, like, an in-universe, like, reenactment of actual Blood Bowl games.
Just sadness.
Oh, and it's God. Just, like, sports commentators, like, just doing their thing, and the fans just being like, what the fuck are we watching? Just
sadness and misery.
Yeah.
And, like, the roles on the kickoff chart could actually be, like, made into scenes and
that'd
stuff.
Be great.
Like, that'd be a cool series.
So, yeah. Ended up, again, the only reason I was not dead last, because I ended up going no wins, three losses and two ties.
Nice, nice.
Because
two ties, and you had an exciting 0-0 tie.
Yes, against another Nurgle team.
Did you had no wins? Did you tie the 1-0 game, or the game that you scored?
Correct. He scored a touchdown in the first half. I scored a touchdown in the second half.
That okay. Shit is wild.
I had another game where someone scored one touchdown on me. No, so there was my 1-1. I had two losses at 1-0 and one loss at 2-0 against the Goblins of all fucking teams. Ended up getting the most vicious award, which is often called most brutal for having inflicted the most casualties.
Yep.
Which I suggested should be called most viscous.
Yeah, which makes sense in this case.
It's a goopy Nurgle trophy.
It is a goopy Nurgle trophy. Jack does a phenomenal job on these things. And, yeah, I had 4 more casualties than the next closest team.
That's pretty cool.
And it would have been a lot more had the Goblins not just ruined my day.
That's awesome.
So, but them's the breaks, right? You can't win them all, or any of them in this case.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun, though. One of the things that was really neat, though, is that much like in Cryfell Cup where there was Horatio on the pitch, if there was nice weather, Melvin would pop out on the pitch.
If it's nice weather? He's too sassy for bad weather?
Correct. Now, the thing about Melvin...
I find that funny. And the nice weather is what, the 7 on the 2d6 chart?
No, it's 4 to 10.
Oh, 4 to 10. Shit, so that's like a constant. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
I knew it was the most common result, but not like...
It's very common.
90% of the chart.
So what Melvin did is he did not block anyone, but he had a lot of special rules that made him a huge pain in the ass if anyone was trying to handle the ball near him. And he would, like, shadow people around, and
he has
tentacles so that it would be hard to, like, dodge away from him, shadowing so that he can still follow even if you do dodge sometimes.
He is very sassy.
And he would move, like, a ball and chain 4 spaces. And the part where it got really fucking crazy... is that if you roll doubles on the weather chart, 2 Melvins popped out.
Oh, that's too sassy.
And he always moves as close as possible towards the ball carrier. So there was a lot of players...
Could you fight him?
You can, and you'd get bonus points for killing him. I would not throw a block against Melvin because he was who we were there for. I'm playing an Urkel team. He's an Urkeling. Like, I'm not going to do it.
Yep, fair enough.
I had 2 opponents kill Melvin, and I was very sad about that. But
he is a demon. He'll be back.
He'll be back.
Yeah.
He's always back.
It can't be his true name. Do you think Melvin's his true name?
No.
That'd be awesome if it was just Melvin. As a Nurgling, I feel like that must be his true name. Like, he's not a great and clean one. It's got some sort of crazy name that's really tough. Like, I feel like you could for sure bind a Nurgling to your will pretty easily.
So there's, like, the... I think it... Was it Drachmian that was the first human on human murder?
Yes.
Then, but his true name is, like... the whispery noise of, like, the guy's final breath.
Yes.
Or do you think his true name is just the sound of the guy that got Melvin for the first time?
Yes.
Just the tortured scream of a guy getting a front wedgie.
100%. 100%.
Ouch.
Front wedgie.
That's so bad. Yeah.
I don't know how you'd spell that, but...
For sure, that's exactly what Melvin is.
But it approximately translates to Melvin, so we go with Melvin.
Melvin.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah. But it was a lot of fun, and the... I honestly... I'm always blown away by the different swag that happens at these tournaments. Like, coming in and getting most vicious also got me another 2 sets of D6 that were logoed to the event and kind of colored around the event, and... like, just getting all the tokens and the coins and the patches. I fucking love it. Almost every single Blood Bowl event I go to has its own patch.
Yep.
On top of the trophies, on top of dice. It's, like, its own custom figure. Like, this
the
figure is
pretty cool.
Yeah, that is some next-level shit.
And speaking of next-level shit, Powtown has revealed everyone that signs up for Powtown is getting 2 Skaven Star players.
Wow.
Like, models. And they're nice. Really?
And they're not. Where are these not coming the ones?
Is it another, like, 3D print?
So we have a bit of... because Jack is so entrenched in the Blood Bowl community, through the pitches that he does, and he does swag for a bunch of people, because he does manufacture, like, he cuts all these trophies and stuff himself. He's kind of developed a rapport with the Hungry Troll guys. I don't know if you've seen them, but they make, like, the Goblin Pirate team and a handful of other ones. They make some, actually, of all of the non-Gita minis, they're probably my favorite. Because unlike Grebo, they're not like just covered in unnecessary detail.
Gotcha.
They're nice, clean sculpts. And so these two, it's the two Gutter Runner star players.
Interesting.
Actually, because the team that won last year was a Skaven team with both those star Gutter Runners. So those are the two models that are being...
Interesting.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. So that's what Powtown does every year, is they do something based on whatever team won last year, impacts the swag for next year.
That's, I like that. That's
that cool. is a really cool tradition.
So like if you come to Powtown this year, you're going to get two free Skaven Star players.
When is the game?
It's the second weekend of June.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I can't make that.
Can you, okay. Can you just register and get Skaven models?
Correct. You can just prepay and get swag.
Interesting.
It'd be $45.
I still need to finish up the mall rats.
Yeah, you do.
I need to start working on that.
But I'm continually floored.
You can't see it, but I'm glaring at Steve right now.
I know, because Mike gave me that box like a year ago.
It was more than a year ago.
Yeah.
Let's go with a year.
I'm pretty sure it's closer to 2 years.
Let's go with a year.
But either way, honestly, I can't say enough how spoiled we are to be Blood Bowl players in Alberta. So if you are a newer player, if you are someone that used to play Blood Bowl back in the day, start coming up to some of these events, because everyone I talked to, like there was a guy who I met at LVO last year who was at Adepticon this year, and he's like, man, Adepticon and LVO are great, but Powtown is the best Blood Bowl tournament I've ever been to, because he went to Powtown last year.
That's awesome.
And just everyone is so friendly. I know I've said this before, but don't worry about if you're new to the game. Like, fuck it. I went 0-2-2, or 0-3-2 on the weekend, and it was a blast.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
So.
I totally agree with that. You don't have to win to have fun.
Yep.
Doesn't hurt, but it's not a requirement by any stretch.
And the guys are so accommodating of new coaches. And we have a kind of a new tradition that was started of the Salty Dice Award. Okay. So there's best sport, and there's also, like, a salt shaker with some dice in it.
That's awesome.
Going out to the coach who just hit his dice shit the bed, but he was still smiling through the whole thing.
Salty dice, I like that.
That's pretty cool. And, yeah, this actually ties into where one of the more recent times I was at Mission recently. Now, one of the staff working there, I just overheard him saying something to one of the other customers. He was talking about, like, oh, there's the Warhammer stuff over there. There's, like, Age of Sigmar, there's Blood Bowl, whatever. Like, he just made, like, an offhand remark about how he likes Blood Bowl, but he's not sure if anybody plays locally. And so, like, I didn't want to interrupt the conversation, but afterwards I was like, yeah, man, like, there's tons of events in and around Alberta and Edmonton and Calgary and Lethbridge and all these places. It's like, you can't go 50 yards in this country without running into a Blood Bowl tournament these days. It's like, these guys are awesome. They have tons of cool events and swag. Like, just hop on the Facebook groups and search for, like, Alberta Blood Bowl events and stuff. Like, you will find groups and events aplenty.
There are three groups, if you're an Edmonton local, that you should know about. One is the Renegade Blood Bowl League. One is the Edmonton Blood Bowl community. And the other one is the Alberta Blood Bowl tournament scene. If you're in Calgary, I'm guessing there's a BBLOC Facebook page. But the Alberta Blood Bowl tournament scene, that page has all the events coming up. There's lots of stuff on there. If you need more information, like, just get out, play some Blood Bowl. It's easy to paint up a team. It's quick to do. And seriously, like, I haven't played Blood Bowl in 14 years, 15 years. And I've missed like three tournaments in the last 2.5.
Yeah, it was pretty solid. Pretty solid. We should move on, occasionally we're
squishy and sassy like this little naked dude.
We're gonna kind of come back to this in a little bit,
yeah,
a roundabout way. So we should probably move on to our next topic, which is a little less cheery in some ways. If anybody is a video game fan, which I imagine that is a significant portion of our audience that might cross over into that genre,
bit of an overlap.
Kotaku today had a piece on the sort of what went wrong with Anthem. Which, if you don't know, is BioWare's latest release. It's their sort of looter shooter game.
The Destiny, don't call it a Destiny clone.
100%, thing. Yeah. and one of the things that we took, Dan and I both read it, and it's pretty scathing of the company itself and sort of what happened. But what really sort of struck me from it, and why we're kind of talking about it in the realm of tabletop gaming, is the culture of that game development studio. And how you can kind of see culture bleed into games gameplay. So I've played quite a bit of Anthem. We'll start, I guess we'll start with Anthem and sort of work towards the tabletop world. But Anthem is clearly a game that has way too many developers involved. Like, it doesn't really know what it wants to be. It was obviously very, very rushed. And it doesn't have really any sort of, like, hook. Do you know what I mean? Like, Mass Effect and some of the other previous BioWare games clearly had, like, Dragon Age, for example, clearly had a feel to the game.
Yeah, they had a vision. They had an identity.
Yeah, and exactly. Anthem is a Destiny clone that has some really cool-looking levels.
It's a sci-fi thing where you fly around and you shoot things, and that's about it.
And it's kind of also set back in the past because the technology's kind of regressed, so it's sci-fi fantasy. It's a weird one. Like, it's doesn't really know what it wants to be. The storyline is
I wonder if that had anything to do with them bringing on a Dragon Age developer to lead the project halfway through.
Yeah, like, it's very muddled. People left. Like, I think it's the tropes of that story are very common to a lot of tabletop games. So obviously that particular piece talked about the culture at BioWare and, you know, people having to take stress leave. And it's pretty obvious the developers there weren't having fun. Like, the main reason you get into game design, having worked in that industry, is because you enjoy it and you want to do something you enjoy, and video games are fun and it should be fun. I don't think that's happening in that studio anymore. And what immediately came to mind for me was the contrast that is right now GW. Like, GW, and also having talked to some of the studio people, and obviously at a convention they're pretty much paid to be, you know, positive about the company, but you can also tell when people are being genuine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And were you just getting, like, the PR phrases?
Yeah, totally. And it's pretty obvious. I mean, also from their marketing stuff, right? Like, GW is having fun.
Oh, fuck this. Yeah. Like, the Servo Skull.
Yeah.
You guys watch that ad for April Fools?
No, I didn't see that one. No.
Oh, fuck, dude. You gotta watch this shit. Yeah. It's like an advertisement for, like, iServo.
Yes, I did see that.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. I did see that entirely. Yeah,
the Duncan Rhodes voiced personal assistant app type
thing. I didn't watch the video, but I looked at the post and thought that was pretty funny.
There's a video. It's amazing. It's, like, fully done. You can, and but yeah, you can just kind of tell when people are being genuine, right? And when Duncan's in the video and he's talking about how he's basically become the online face of Games Workshop, and so he's going to be doing the voice for this iServo, and it'd be like, you ask it questions of, hey, what should I highlight this color with, or whatever? And it's like sitting on this guy's painting desk while he's working on some stuff. And
that's amazing.
Yeah. And then they had a section, which I'm super hopeful that they do something with, at the bottom of the post, where it was like, ask a question for Duncan to answer.
Yes.
Did you put one in there?
I did, totally.
What was yours?
Mine was, is this going to be real?
Mine was, what is the best paint or best tasting paint?
Oh, interesting.
Oh, to print shining gold.
Well, obviously, but they can't say that anymore because they don't make it anymore.
True. Although it was a classic.
Fucking candy.
But actually, one of the ones that I saw a lot of people trying to, like, on Twitter and other places trying to get people to type it in was, when is the coming soon page from Black Library coming back? Because they used to say which month, like, the next few months' releases were going to be coming out, like, in what order.
Mm-hmm.
And that stopped being a thing. They took that page down.
Interesting.
So people are like, oh, so there's these limited edition, like, several hundred dollar books coming out eventually, but I don't know when to budget for it.
Interesting.
Mm.
So,
well, in reality, with Games Workshop, just always assume you're spending about $800 a month.
Like, fair. Totally fair.
And then you can get a third of the product they're releasing that month.
But with the Black Library books, which they've pledged to make changes to how the system is going to work, but for a lot of these limited edition Black Library ones, like, they were crashing the website and selling out within minutes kind of territory. So they also said there was going to be a North American launch for the first book of the Solar War series.
Yeah, yeah. That immediately went sideways.
But yeah, I think they were supposed to reserve copies for the North American launch, and, like, not at 3 a.m., and they did not.
I think this kind of demonstrates my point, though, that because that studio is clearly enjoying what they're doing and doing a good job of it, the fans here, like, immediately as soon as we started talking about GW, everybody's got something to say. Yeah. And it's pretty much positive, even though it's the fact, when I say pretty much positive, you still want that book, even though they completely fucked up the delivery of it.
Yep.
Because there's a lot of sentiment towards GW to give them a bit of a break, and because they're doing so well.
And sweet leather-bound books that cost $200. I mean, you gotta have them.
Exactly. But so then you look at something like BioWare, where they had their initial release was an older version of the game, and then they quickly fixed it. But because it was an older release, people immediately assumed it was garbage.
Yeah,
because they had no room to, like, there was no goodwill with the fans.
The EA Early Access build was the wrong build.
Yeah.
So it was several weeks out of date and buggy and didn't have certain features that it was supposed to. Like, that is really unfortunate.
Yeah, but that's exactly what I'm saying, right? Like, you compare the two companies and clearly the culture. And one of the things that's also interesting is a studio like GW, where they have constant rolling releases, like basically every week something cool is coming out. If it's not every week, it's every second week for sure.
Yeah.
Right? That also keeps your fan base interested. And one of the things that kind of compares in a way is the way Destiny 2 was updated. Destiny 2, when it came out, was pretty bad, but it had rolling releases and new features being added.
That episodic content that some games are like, the game as a service kind of model.
Yeah, totally. You pay a season's pass fee and you get content basically weekly, right? And that's sort of what GW does. And in a lot of ways, I think that also takes some stress off the game designers and developers, because they don't have to plan an 8th edition release. They don't have to plan a Eldar Codex. They don't have a deadline for that, right? Like, they have, I mean, obviously they did, but because it was such a pace, it kind of, you can kind of forget about the misses. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Versus what they used to do. And I think this also kind of comes back to how GW's culture used to be, where it was, here's your Dark Eldar Codex for 3rd edition. You'll get one in 5th.
Yeah, you won't get another book for 10 years.
Well, even let's say best case scenario, Space Marines.
Yeah.
And I think after 3rd edition, where I believe they got 2.
In 3rd edition? I don't know.
Was it 4th that they got 2? I don't know.
One of them. Either way, but you're getting at least one per edition if you're playing Space Marines.
Sure, yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But now, you, like, look at Chaos. Chaos suddenly, just out of nowhere, has 3 weeks of releases, plus the Slaanesh stuff that's coming at some point in time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Eldar now have a Yunari Codex coming out, and we're probably going to have, there's the rumor page today. Looks like it might be something Homunculus Covens related. There's
or Fabius Bile.
Or Fabius Bile. Who knows? But the point is these rolling releases, I think, take a lot of stress out of the game design department and make it a lot easier to focus on having fun instead of just this massive splash release. That is the way GW used to be.
So it was kind of all or nothing.
All or nothing, totally. And then, so, I mean, you have sort of the Anthem side of things contrasted with what GW is doing. But then also in the tabletop world, we've had other companies that have sort of suffered, I think, in the same sort of way, like Hawk.
Or Weird.
Weird. Hawk had, I'm blanking on it now, Drop Fleet.
And Drop Fleet, yeah.
Drop Which, Fleet was a big release. Kickstarter, huge.
I was just going to say that all or nothing approach really ties into how Kickstarters work, where that's usually not trickle-out content. That's usually just, like, you get 3 years worth of shit all at once.
Yeah.
And then nothing for several years as they build up to the next project.
I'd be really interested to see what that... I mean, that's obviously a much smaller studio than something that's, you know, working on a AAA title. But at the same time, I wonder what Hawk Studio pressure was like, if some of that initial, we're building this really cool Drop Zone game, it's coming out of my garage, there's a ton of passion around it, versus we're looking at getting bought by a bigger company, we have this huge Kickstarter that's on its way, we have basically shareholders that are investing in our product. Suddenly there's a lot more stress to it in my mind, and I wonder if that didn't affect Hawk.
Well, I'm just wondering, Mike, like, you probably played Drop Zone and Drop Flute the most out of any of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you seen or heard anything?
Oh, they're still trickling, but it's mostly... actually, it's not true. It's trickling, but it's not a big press release or anything. It's like, oh yeah, we're going to release this. And then you don't hear anything about it for months. And then it's there, but there's no big trumpet or fanfare. It just kind of appeared. And unless you were watching at the time it appeared, you don't even notice it's there. So I think there's been about 3 or 4 releases for Drop Fleet and a couple, maybe 5 for Drop Zone. But they're not... out there publicly. They're not.
Did
there's not being the public's not being made aware of it?
Did second edition occur?
No.
No.
That's the one that's interesting to me, that that hasn't happened, because that was a big announcement. It was on a bunch of different shows.
Like 2 years ago, wasn't it?
Yeah,
about 2 years ago. That.
It was supposed to happen in the fall and then last spring, and now it's just the spring after that. And I don't know what it is, but this is all underneath the new company.
Yeah, I mean, this is still very similar to a lot of the video game world, where suddenly a title gets pushed back and interest wanes and people want their money back from their pre-orders or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's some definite parallels there. And you mentioned Weird, Tom. I don't know enough about Weird.
Well, they kind of hit the same problem too, right? Like they had the other side Kickstarter because they decided to release a new game that no one was really asking for. Sound familiar?
Yeah. Sounds kind of like Spartan.
That looked kind of cool, but, you know, it was one of those things where their Kickstarter took months and months and months to come out, like, longer than it was expected to, and the communication was really weak from the company, and people weren't seeing anything, they weren't hearing anything, mm-hmm. and then now they're doing third edition, and, like, I don't know. I'm having a hard time giving a fuck.
Yep.
And Malifaux, as anyone that's listened to this podcast since we started, is a game that I used to really play a lot of.
Yep. Dead gremlins really riding pigs and chickens and all kinds of weird things. That is so Tom.
Yeah, but...
But then, to me, it felt like they oversaturated everything and they made it too much. There was too much that you had to do, too much to keep up.
Mm. There was just so much kind of going on, but not in the same way. And the other problem with Weird, too, is that they would... You know, pre-release something at Gen Con or, like, the Easter sale, and then it would take 6 months to get it on the regular shelves. So if you didn't buy at those times, then you weren't necessarily getting to play with those toys anytime soon. People that did would be able to take those and play those in games, and so you had to keep track of models that were actually out, models that were not out yet, and there was this whole fucking thing. And
was it ever pay to win? Like, if you had those models, you were just at a clear advantage?
Yeah, probably. Not really, but...
Okay. That's good.
Like, it was never that they were that much better, but there was also the case of if you had those models and knew how they worked, not all your opponents would know how they worked.
Oh, yeah, a little bit of a meta.
So there was kind of like the meta pay to win, but not an actual pay to win, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So, yeah, I don't know. I think for me, a lot of it comes down to communication, right? And I feel that, you know, if we want to just be a little bit Edmontonian for a second and think about... When we, like, during the decade of darkness, going on 1.5 decades with the Oilers, when the culture around the team has been really shitty is when you don't see much communication.
Yeah.
And you're not getting that constant flow of information between basically the seller, which is the team, and the consumer, which is us. Whereas Games Workshop, you look at what they've been doing, they've been communicating so clearly with their fan base.
Yep, I'll give you that.
And they have a great portal for that through the community page, and they've been going to more events than they ever have in different shows and previewing stuff and engaging with people. And they go to the LVO, and you've got studio guys
to talk to. They go to Adepticon, they go to Nova. Yeah, no, I hear you.
So they're they're seemingly a fairly transparent company. At least more so than, like, we still don't
know. Which is why I think a lot of people give GW now, I mean, they definitely used to not do this, give them a bit of a benefit of the doubt. Like, if there is a release that's not totally up to snuff, people are okay with it. They're not going to drag them through the fire.
Yeah.
It's interesting. What I'm kind of getting at is if I could be, like, a fly on the wall in some of these game studios and take a look at what happens at GW versus BioWare versus Weird, Hawk, you name it. I was going to say also Privateer Press. Love to see what their process is too.
Mm-hmm.
I'd really like to know, like, who's having fun and does it actually show up in their games? And also, I mean, is there a professional project manager side of things? Like, how... I feel like a lot of cases... that's probably not the case unless you are at a GW level company. Like, I feel like Hawk probably doesn't have a project manager. He is the project manager.
He was.
That wasn't the time. He had, like, by being bought out by the larger company, he can be more the creative side and they do all the logistics and stuff. Whereas he was doing everything for a long time. Yeah.
Hawk was like, he was a kind of a one man show. Don't get me wrong. He had people that helped him, but the majority of the shit that was on his shoulders, and I think that is also one of the reasons why it was too much. He had to give it up, right?
I don't blame him. I mean, it's a case of scale, right, in my mind. If you...
That's very much where I was hoping this would go.
Like, if you are... Because let's be honest here. GW is smaller than BioWare. Smaller than EA, for sure. So when you start going up to EA scale, you have dedicated project managers. And I imagine GW does, too. But their projects have to be a little bit different because it's one person writing a codex or it's a small team writing the rules. Like, it's very much smaller than, like, let's say 200-300 developers. And I don't know how you could bring some of that culture from GW to BioWare or improve Weird or whatever. I'm not sure if that's something you can salvage. At the same time, GW kind of did.
I think a lot of it was just because GW went through, you know, the corporate buyout stage where they became, you know, publicly traded quite a while ago.
Yeah.
And they went through, like, they had their dark periods. They had their soulless evil empire stage. But I think they were able to kind of, like, somehow weather that and bring it back and start bringing back some of the personalities that had maybe left in the past.
Yeah.
And getting them more involved again to instill some of that.
It's interesting you mentioned that because coming back to BioWare, Casey Hudson is back.
Yeah.
I wonder if that will actually right the ship. If it is a personality thing, because I've never been huge on that idea that, like, one person at the top can totally just change an organization. But Kirby,
to be fair, one person at the top can change the way you operate. If you had too many constraints and too many restrictions before, that person comes in and changes it, makes it easier for it.
Sure.
And one voice.
It might even be huge things, but if it's enough small things, it makes your life easier, makes your job more enjoyable. That's all it takes. Because if there's too much restriction, too many loopholes that you have to dance for, any kind of job is going to become boring and
tedious for sure,
and it'll suck the life out of you, right? And the creativity out of you as well, right?
Totally.
So I mean,
that's a very good point.
That to me, yes, one man can make a difference.
I think
if the structure was too choking.
Yeah, like fair. Because I think one of your previous criticisms before was with Anthem specifically, it kind of had that feel of a design by committee.
Oh, totally.
Kind of feel to it. And that came out in the Kotaku article as well, where they were just talking about how there'd be endless meetings where nothing would get definitively resolved. They'd go away with the same list of problems as when they started.
Yeah.
Whereas if you can have that one person that brings a very clear, decisive, and still well-measured approach to these meetings, they can actually make decisions and cut through all those voices to, like, keep everybody on the same page, on the same vision.
Yeah.
And having good, effective leadership really does clear up a lot of those muddy waters, I think.
Yeah, and you can also get to a point, too, where you can focus back on the bigger picture, right, of what is it we're doing. And I think for Games Workshop, they had, during their dark times, they were a model maker, not a game company.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard that mantra in a few years now.
Totally.
Right? Like, they are making games that people want to play.
Yep.
They're creating an experience for people to have fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I think the game design studio side of things, because it was interesting, when we were at the LVO and at the studio preview, they were talking about, yes, the models are designed months in advance. We write the rules for the models. Because at the end of the day, Sculptor needs to be creative.
The design window is longer for
the design window is longer. And if somebody is looking at a particular kit and it's great, they're going to produce it. Because part of it is that they are a model company. They do need to sell cool models. If they produced garbage, we wouldn't buy it because it wouldn't look cool.
Correct.
So there does have to be that aesthetic piece there. But then at the same time, so the rules side of things has to write for the models. But I think it is, you're right, it's a hand-in-hand thing. It's not a models company, rules later. It's a models company first, yes, but that's a necessity. Rules are just as important.
Yeah. And it's not even just the notion of rules, but the idea of it being games.
Mm-hmm.
So when I think about...
It needs to be fun. You need to get your model, and you need to be able to play with it and have fun with it and, do the whole thing.
So I think an interesting segue into our next conversation is that Blood Bowl has an organization called the NAF. And if you haven't heard us talk about it before, it's basically a global governing body that more or less oversees, like, a ranking system they give tournament certification to be part of the NAF, and you have to have certain... It's basically like Blood Bowl ITC.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Except it's been around for probably 20 years longer.
Yeah, just there's more people playing the ITC, so you probably might be more familiar with that. But totally the exact same thing.
Yeah, I would argue maybe not.
Okay.
So the Worlds
yeah.
stopped registration for Blood Bowl
yeah.
at 1,400 players.
Whew! That's spicy.
Yeah.
Yeah, Europe likes their Blood Bowl.
It's a hot fucking take, Steve.
That's spicy. I did not know that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That is one tournament.
That's very interesting. Because I only see that from the local side of things and North America. Like, Blood Bowl is never that big in North America.
The fact that Blood Bowl survived and had a, like, if not commercially thriving business for a long time, it had that tournament culture and just the scene never went away.
Yeah.
When the company that made the game stopped for, what, 10, 15 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
like, there's not, like, if GW stopped making 40K... How long do you think that game would still be played at, like, an ITC level?
That's interesting. I don't know. Right now, maybe a while. 5 years ago? I don't know.
But yeah, it's... I think that's an interesting parallel, though. Like,
yeah, totally.
So, anyway. with that in mind...
I wonder how many registered players NAF has versus, like, over the entire season. Like, how many people play in an ITC event versus how many people play in a NAF event?
I could find the numbers for you, cool. But I can tell you that my NAF number is 24,000.
Interesting. That would, like, be probably on...
Your membership number sort of a thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd probably be on par with the ITC this year, but I don't know. You joined a while ago.
Yeah. And it was like 24 something.
They're in the tens of thousands, if not twenties of thousands for... I know for a fact... Tens of thousands for ITC.
Yeah.
So, somewhere around there.
Wouldn't surprise me if... Nah. I can double check these things for you later.
Really concerned. So, that's super cool. I had no idea.
Yeah, complete sidebar. So, Blood Bowl, if you're going through the NAF, the way, and you're running a tournament, the way it works is that you figure out what your tournament rules are. You submit that to the tournament representative through the NAF, and he will say, yes, this can be a NAF tournament, or no, this cannot be a NAF tournament.
When would it not be a NAF tournament?
If it's too weird.
Okay.
To the point where the rankings might not be fair.
Okay.
Because ultimately you get rankings based on your win-loss ratios for your teams that you've played. And so you can have a ranking for every race that you've ever played on the NAF.
Gotcha.
And so as of right now, they've actually been really permissive with different events. Like the Food Bowl event that we ran last September, where you could basically pay for rerolls.
Yep.
With donations,
they allowed.
That's pretty cool.
We're starting to see more and more variety in the tournaments that we're playing, where, like, again, there was the...
I'm drinking a terrible beer. I'm gonna get a new one.
That's why horrible. I gave you the option for a Rainier.
I'm gonna go get it. You didn't want that.
I was gonna drink it.
You don't want it.
Anyways, so like I said before, at March Madness there was Melvin on the pitch. There was different for like the extreme weathers. They had different table or different things on the chart that would modify what exactly Admantor did. Cryfowl Cup had the same thing. We're looking at having for the Blood Diamond Chalice. Some of the talking was either having like a little bat on the pitch because it's kind of like a vampire theme. I was suggesting, and I hope we end up doing this, where everyone starts with like five Blood Diamond tokens. And I know.
Is there like a really bad South African accent involved?
No, there is not.
Okay.
But the trophy for the tournament is a big bowl. And then so you get five of these tokens, and as you're putting, like, the droplets of blood in the chalice each game, the first one on a 2+, you get a reroll. On a 1, one of your players gets Bloodthirsty.
Okay.
The second time you do it, it's a 3+ to get the reroll. A 1 or a 2 makes that player Bloodthirsty. And so on and so forth, going up until you've used all 5. And it's just for the tournament. So, like, a little tweak like that.
Okay.
And we're starting to see the Blood Bowl events are really diversifying really well because the person who's kind of higher up in the NAF is letting us do this, so long as they don't fuck too much with skill packs.
Sure.
Or seemingly hinder certain particular factions.
Sure.
Unfairly. It seems like play what you want, have fun with games, and go out and enjoy yourself.
Gotcha. That's cool.
So we were kind of talking about transitioning over to talking about kind of like your local culture.
Yeah.
Or tournament culture.
Yeah.
And so kind of talking about some of the stuff we've been doing with Blood Bowl. Also swag. Like, fuck, there's patches for every tournament. So I've got my vest that's just getting covered.
But that comes back to sort of culture, too. Like, I think just like an organization, like a game development studio or whatever, can have a very particular culture that clearly makes playing the game fun. I think your local scene and your tournament organizers, like the TOs around your particular scene, can also have that same effect. You've kind of convinced me a little bit, Mike, with your point that one person can totally make that difference. Yeah. Like, I know there's been a lot of events here in town that have been received as either good or bad, and it's usually based on the
personality of the TO.
Yeah. And I think also the personality of the event too, right? Like, even some of the more run by committee events where there isn't really one particular personality necessarily, I'm thinking of a lot of the Out of the Basement events, they've always had the personality around it's a charity event. So it's a food bank event, which is something that when it started was pretty novel, and it's kind of persisted through. People want to go and support those events because of that aspect.
And just having something that makes your event or makes your league kind of unique or fun or exciting.
Yeah, totally.
Right? Because at the end of the day, if we... And it doesn't have to be things that are fundamentally changing how you play. It could be these little tweaks. It could just be having a cool theme for your event.
Yeah.
Because I've seen Phil runs a lot of events. I don't know how much he's changing the rules for the games.
Very little.
But he's making a really cool theme about the event.
Yeah.
There's a narrative around the event happening.
Yeah. Big Showdown, Little Catachan. It was a great team event. And one of the things that he really likes to push, and this is a subtle thing, but he likes to have good terrain. He likes to have a couple of tables that are very themed and very cool. And that, unfortunately, I mean, I wish every tournament you went to had incredible scenery, but it's just not feasible.
Warhammered is another great example.
Yeah, it has a bit of a theme. That's
Paul, though. He makes every table. Yeah. He always has... Every table is unique and has special terrain.
Totally. I don't want to take anything away from Paul, but 40K requires a little bit more... Age of Sigmar now, I don't actually know 100%. I don't follow that game as much. But Fantasy used to need a little less terrain. Having, like, super-themed 40K tables is a little bit more interesting. And the fact that Phil was trying to do that is super cool for 40K players.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So what I'm saying is, for a 40K player, that's a cool little thing that Phil was doing. But you're totally right. With Warhammer, there's an extra theme around Warhammer that I think we're kind of maybe missing, a bit of a culture. Cheers.
Cheers.
but yeah, no, and I mean, you're coming back to personality. I don't think you can get more... more personality than Paul. Like, that is one of the reasons to go to that event, is because he's running it.
And it is sort of an overlap again with the video game studio analogy of just how important community managers are, whether it's on the social media, whether it's on like a Twitch community or what have you. Like, community managers, because we live in that digital age where everybody's on social media,
everybody has a
potential to be really loud and impact a lot of other people. Having community managers that can really set the tone.
Yeah.
And
not even just
to police the discussion whenever, but to like lead by example and just guide things in like a positive direction. Like, it goes a long freaking way. And that is something that, again, can and is being brought into the tabletop space as well.
Totally. To
fantastic ends.
And something to remember is that people that are doing this stuff in your local scenes, they're typically not getting paid. Like a TO, they're never making money. Like someone that's running a league for something, again, they're doing it because they love it.
Yeah.
And
I've heard people say, though, like, people make a lot of money in these tournaments. I can assure anybody that's listening that thinks that we might be talking about this, having been involved with Out of the Basement and knowing some other...
To be fair, if you can make money, if you have LVO... type
and you're selling sponsorships
and
I doubt they make money off the LVO. Like, Frontline Gaming makes money as an entity through their store, through their promotional stuff that they do.
Well,
I'd be really surprised if LVO made money.
I was talking to Reese a couple of years ago, and they basically every year for the LVO they put their business on the line, is they basically extend themselves to the point where if people didn't show up to the LVO, Frontline Gaming would just be done.
Yeah, because they're basically renting an entire casino in Vegas.
Yeah, it's a. I mean, and that goes for your local events too. Is there?
They have to rent a space.
They got to rent a space. And yeah, usually it's out of pocket. And
there's a lot of cash changing hands, but you might be out several thousand dollars in table rentals, depending on your venue and the size of the tournament.
Yeah, so I mean, you're right. Your point that these people are basically volunteers for the community. It's because they're doing something that they want to see succeed generally. I mean, there's I can't imagine a case where that isn't the thing. I don't want to delve into that, where some people want to pad their rankings, but generally that's not the case.
There's always, you can, no matter what you're doing, you can always find an example of that one time or that two times where someone was an asshole, game the system, whatever. Yeah. But like, I'm going to be honest with you, all the events I've run over the years, more often than not, I've paid money for other people to play games.
Totally. Yep.
Right? Yep. Like, you know, there's been some years where we made some money that we put right back into terrain and stuff.
Yes.
You know, but especially those early years out of the basement, like, fucked up.
Oh, there was a couple years out of the basement where we made, like, $50.
And all of that money was coming out of our pockets. Yeah. And, you know, making terrain and doing all those things. And
hundreds of hours of unpaid labor.
Yeah, like... really respect your community leaders.
Yeah, Mike knows all that stuff.
Oh, too. No, I know. There's the times where I got so mad where I heard people accusing us of basically ripping off the community and taking them for money, because why aren't we just charging $10 or $15 for this tournament? Because
you bought $1,200 for the scenery to put on the event.
Yeah, exactly. They just don't get it. Just like... those kind of tournaments that you're seeing that are that cheap are usually run out of somebody's store, and that's because that person is letting you have that rent space for free in the hopes that the people that come will buy his product.
Yeah.
You go anywhere else, you have room rental, you have table rental, you have to buy more scenery, buy more mats.
Yeah, mats is a thing.
You have to buy swag, because you know what? Everybody wants swag when they go to a tournament.
Yeah.
And all of these things add up very quickly. Oh, you want a bar. You have to have a bartender. Yeah. You have to have a license. You have to,
trophies get really fucking expensive.
Totally. Trophies, exactly. And then by the time you're looking at it, it's a $6,000-$7,000 tab. And if you have X amount of people, you will break even or maybe make $100.
Yeah.
But if any of those things change and you don't, hello, people who say I'm going to come and then don't bother, screw you.
Yeah.
basically, that can screw it up and that person ends up losing money.
But that's the other thing, too, is the... knowing that the event is going to be good, that's where you kind of, in a lot of ways, having a personality or a track record is so important for these events. That, okay, yes, it's $100. There's a tournament next weekend that's $15.
Yeah.
But these people, this group does such a good job. These people that run Blood Bowl, the Blood Bowl community, I'll go pay $60 or whatever, right? Like, I'll go to the LVO because I know it's going to be good. I'll pay my $100 for my ticket. That's fine. And I think if you have the culture around the event and that community appreciates it, you'll be fine. But getting there it can be not the most straightforward thing.
It can be hard, right? And a lot of the times, I think people need to, if you're looking at starting out, running a tournament or an event or a league or something, you need to start with, so what's fun? And what are the people that I want at my event going to be doing to have fun?
Yep.
And how can I promote that? And then you kind of build everything up from there. Because if people are not having fun playing the games at your event, there's no fucking point to having it. It doesn't matter.
Having a really pretty video game with no actual gameplay.
100%. Full circle. Totally. Totally.
And honestly, finding something that makes it uniquely your own, right? So Barry and I were driving back.
That's also full circle, uniquely your own.
Right? And Barry and I were driving back from the tournament this last weekend, and the thought came in our heads of, well, should we run another Blood Bowl tournament? Because there's some really big ones in Calgary. We've got a couple in Edmonton. Like, maybe we need another one. And ultimately, we decided, fuck it, we're just going to make Food Bowl even bigger.
Yeah.
Because it's an event we've already started. People already came to it, already had a lot of fun. Instead of trying to throw yet another tournament into the works, I'll just keep running the same one I already have been.
Yep.
And this year is going to be fucking wild, because there's going to be a skill wheel.
Interesting. Like a Wheel of Fortune?
Yeah.
Nice. Like it.
So.
And that is a thing that, I mean, some people, and that you also have to gauge that about your community too. Like some communities are going to go random thing that can affect my performance.
You might have to build up to that.
Yep.
Yeah. And the punchline is that if you want to mitigate that randomness, you can completely do it with food bank donations.
Yeah, I
totally. So it's to the nature of the event.
Exactly. And if people know they're in a pay to win, but for charity, it's a little easier to stomach.
Yeah, right? And it's just something, and everyone that came in had a great time.
Yeah.
And just finding a way that makes your event unique and your event fun. And then listen to your players as well. Like, I think being able to have a really open and fair discourse as league organizers, as TOs, and as gamers. And just being really civil with each other, right? Yeah, like, totally. Make sure you're giving everyone the benefit of the doubt.
Fuck, that is very... This all ties in very, very well. When I proposed this topic, I did not think it was going to be this perfect. But that's totally... The discourse is an actual thing that's important. Give feedback in a positive and meaningful way. Like, if you had an issue with the event, and you... I mean, providing you also want to see the community grow, that feedback is important. I know Out of the Basement used to always ask for feedback. Never got a ton. Which is, it's tough to badger people for feedback, but you are part of the community. Help it grow.
Yeah, and part of that is, I guess, the approach to, if you're asking people who are packing up their shit and trying to drive home on a Sunday afternoon, they're tired, they got to get back to their families and get ready for work the next day, it's tough to get somebody to, like, fill out an exit survey on the way out.
Totally.
But if you can tell some of these people, hey, we're going to have, like, I don't want to use the word post-mortem, because that's a very specific industry term for something else, but like, we'll have a follow-up event. We're going to meet at fucking Brewster's or whatever a week after the event on a Saturday night. People who came to the tournament should come, grab a couple of beers, talk about how the experience went and how to improve it for next time. Like,
it's not a terrible idea. It is a post-mortem. Like that is a post-mortem entirely.
And getting people to come out to go grab a couple of beers and talk about Warhammer is probably easier than asking somebody to fill out a survey when they're tired.
100%.
Yeah, we did also, there was a few times we did like a Survey Monkey survey. So you just be like, you emailed it out to everyone that attended.
Registered, yeah.
Those are kind of cool. But yeah, just more opportunities to hang out and have fun is always a good thing.
And hanging out and grabbing beers with the guys or whatever, like, that's community building also.
Totally. And I mean, if you want to get people, let's say, hey, you know what? You didn't have enough rules judges this year. There wasn't a ringer. Well, now that the person's out, maybe they're going to be involved with the scene and help you run the event or whatever, right?
Like, yeah, more volunteers.
Totally. You can definitely grow the scene that way, especially if those people are invested in making that community better or that game better.
But yeah, I think the main point for all this is that these types of communities and cultures, they don't happen by accident.
No. And like, it's very easy to destroy them.
Absolutely.
Very easy to destroy them.
But like, you know, any kind of personal relationship, if both parties are putting in the effort and meeting in the middle, like, you can do some really cool things.
Yeah. Totally.
My biggest thing is make sure it's constructive criticism. Criticize as much as you want, but make it constructive. Don't be, you guys are assholes, I don't like you.
Don't make it personal. Screw you. Propose some solutions and ideas along with the criticism.
Because, exactly, quite honestly, otherwise, it's more than half of the people that criticize usually end up stepping over that line and making it more personal than constructive.
That is always one of the things. People don't know how to criticize anymore. People know how to complain.
Yeah.
And criticism is in an attempt to make things better.
Yeah. But right? Complaining can literally destroy a community.
Oh, totally.
Well, because again, coming back to this point, your TOs are not making money. Your league organizers are not making money. They're doing this for free because they love the game.
And if it sucks, they're going to walk away.
And then what's going
to happen? They have nothing on the line other than... The only thing they have on the line is stuff to lose.
Yeah. They've got not a lot to gain, but an awful lot financially and just hobby passion-wise.
Totally. To
yeah, absolutely.
There's nothing that'll drive you faster from a game than trying to put on a cool event and having not very many people show up. And in fairness, like, there can be all kinds of factors behind that, but then having a few people that show up be dicks about it.
Yep.
Like, you know what? If someone runs their first event and it's not great, give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they just didn't know better.
Yeah.
Give them some feedback. Maybe offer some help.
It's interesting because indie games get a ton of leeway for that. Oh, it's the studio's first game. It's somebody's, you know, out of their basement attempt at game development. They had a ton of leeway. But as soon as you've done it a couple of times, there's basically no leeway.
Yeah, you get that what's your excuse? This is a sequel kind of mentality.
Totally. And why isn't this bigger and better than last year?
And it's a getting off topic, but that is one of the big issues with video game industry, with tabletop gaming industry, it being the small scale garage operation, indie, whatever, and being GW, where they're fully established and have tons of capital and everything, those positions are relatively easy to operate from. The whole in between and the growth progression is extremely difficult, and that's where a lot of video game studios fail. That's where a lot of tabletop game studios fail. It's when they're trying to do like a massive organizational change. If they don't do it right, it's going to blow up in their face.
That's also the other thing, is people have so much expectation. I think this also comes from, this also applies to tournaments. When you have things that happen once a year, there's a lot of time for people to build expectations, right? They form their memories about the previous event or previous game or previous release or whatever it is. And then they think this is what should be the next game. They don't realize that these are separate works that stand on their own a lot of times, and separate tournaments that should stand on their own. I mean, you have people that leave tournaments, like without the base, and we had total turnover of people running the events. I was one of the people that left, right? Mm-hmm. Didn't want to do it anymore.
I couldn't take it anymore, honestly. I was just tired of the negativity.
Yeah, totally.
In generally.
Every single person at this table at one point or another was running out of the basement events.
Yeah, and just couldn't take it.
Yeah, and then you, or at least at the very minimum, volunteering with it. And it's the same thing in the video game industry. People that started there are now out. One of the guys I know that was one of the best programmers I ever worked with is now a botanist, went back to school and wanted to be as far away from computers as possible because of that industry. Like, it's, and I think the same, people are all, because a tournament organizer is involved with their hobby and it's once or twice a year, it's harder for them to be chased away from the hobby, because running a tournament is very adjacent to the hobby. It isn't playing a game. It's very different. So I think it's harder to chase people out of playing that game, but it's super easy to chase them out of running events.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. It's probably easier than chasing them out of a job or whatever else. Right. So it's, yeah, I think culture is an interesting one. It's, like I said, it's super easy to destroy, really hard to build.
Yeah, so hopefully people choose to take that for the positive and try to build rather than destroy.
Totally.
It's real easy to destroy shit, and it's really fun, too. That's not what we're trying to say here.
Well, I don't think anybody's talking about it being fun, because everybody, I mean, I can't really think of anybody that, other than the ulterior motive of I want to play events to boost my own standing, there really is no reason to tear down the gaming community.
And it's the barriers to entry stop some of the just like non-fan troll type assholes that plague video games versus board games, just because the investment required is higher. But yeah,
I don't think it's reasonable to think that people in this hobby are going to purposely chase or destroy the community.
But that's not the issue, really. It's people aren't intentionally going to destroy the community. What it is they're not happy, and they want to be happy, but their actions are destroying the
community. Yeah, exactly. It's inadvertent.
So it's inadvertent, but they are destroying the community at the same time when they're doing it. And I think that's what the problem is. There's no recognition that what you're doing is not helping the community. It's helping yourself, but it's destroying everything else out there.
I agree. I think that's a reasonable, concern for sure. Interesting one. So come to our event. We'll have more information on it, but it looks like we're going to be running a 40K event July 13th and 14th. The hall is booked. Registration is not open yet. Player pack is not open or not up yet, but it will be coming soon.
Should be soon.
Yeah.
And this will be the first time that just Steve and I have run an event together, so give us a grain of salt on this one.
We should be okay. We've run events before.
It'll be fine.
Together. As long as we don't tear each other apart, it'll be fine.
Oh, I'll tear you apart.
You know, limb from limb. Hopefully.
Oh, I was.
I don't.
Let's move on.
Tom.
Let's move on.
Okay, so
I'm wiry.
Let's just say I'm going to take this pose.
Sassy Tom.
Sassy Tom.
I have no doubt there will be that pose during the event at some point in time.
Oh man, it'd be so good.
Okay.
It'd be so good.
We should wrap this one up.
Yeah. So until next time, this has been another episode of Hobbit in Canada. I'm Tom.
I'm Dan.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Steve.
And play some games, paint some models, and have some fun.